Our support comes from Riverwoods at Exeter, a not-for-profit life care community for independent living in the Seacoast region, with information at www.riverwoods-exeter.org. And Seaver and McClellan Antiques, featuring fine and decorative arts from a variety of cultural traditions, located at the corner of Routes 101 and 137 in Dublin. Open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 till 5. Considerable cloudiness developing today, a chance of a few sprinkles as well, the high around 53. You're listening to the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio. WEVO 89.1 in Concord and Manchester, WEVH 91.3 in Hanover and the Upper Valley, WEVN 90.7 serving Keene and southwest New Hampshire, WRND 91.7 in Manchester. We operate translator stations W212AF at 90.3 in Nashua and W282AB at 104.3 in Dover. We are your choice for NPR News and classical music. It's 9 o'clock.
You probably don't spend much time thinking about inventions and patents, but the Founding Fathers did. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution specifies that authors and inventors will have, for a limited time, the exclusive rights to their respective writings and discoveries. I'm Laura Kanoy, and coming up next on The Exchange, Inventing. We'll talk about patents and how inventions go from bright idea to reality. Also, how many of history's biggest breakthroughs came from independent or university researchers, not large companies. The Wright brothers were bicycle mechanics before they invented their airplanes, and electric light came from an Ohio farm boy with an eighth grade education, Thomas Edison. Stay with us for The Exchange, right after the news on New Hampshire Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. 1 week after the massacre at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, President Clinton plans to unveil a new package of gun control measures. Some of the items in the package he has advocated before. They include extending the Brady handgun waiting period, mandating background checks for gun show sales, and requiring child safety locks. The package is part of an anti-crime bill that's been in the works for some time. The White House says the Littleton tragedy gives the measure new urgency. Spokesman Joe Lockhart says the chances are good this year that Congress will pass the measure. Belgrade was hit again by NATO airstrikes as the 34th night of NATO's offensive came closer to Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic's power base. NPR's Silvia Poggioli has a report from Belgrade.
The capital, Belgrade, was hit once again after having been spared for 2 days. NATO planes blasted the building that houses Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic's Socialist Party. The Yugoslav news agency Tanjug reported that two missiles hit the 23-story Ustje Business Center, crushing the TV transmitter on the roof. The transmitter had been used by the Kosovo radio and television station owned by Milosevic's daughter Maria and by another TV station run by a close friend of Milosevic's wife, Mirjana Marković. The detonation was so strong that the debris caused damage to nearby buildings. It blew out several large window panes on the ground floor of the Hyatt Hotel, where most foreign journalists are staying. Firemen and police cordoned off the area immediately after the attack. There was no fire at the site, but a large cloud of dust hung over the building. This is Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Belgrade.
The Red Cross hopes today to formally visit three U.S. soldiers being held captive in Yugoslavia. Claire Doule reports from Geneva.
The Red Cross is crossing its fingers it will be allowed to meet the three U.S. soldiers in private sometime today. Yesterday, a delegation chatted briefly with the men who've been held in a secret destination since their capture on March the 31st. Today, it's hoped a Red Cross doctor will be in the party, allowed to spend time alone with the men, checking their personal details and health. A Red Cross official has already spoken to the men's families, and reports have gone to the Yugoslav and U.S. authorities. The Red Cross stresses under the terms of the Geneva Convention it can't make public the conversations nor give an assessment of the men's physical and mental health. For NPR News, this is Claire Doule in Geneva.
An F-16 fighter jet crashed in flames last night in the rugged mountains west of Phoenix, Arizona. The two pilots ejected safely. It was the sixth crash in 6 months of an F-16 based at nearby Luke Air Force Base. All 400 of the nation's F-16s, equipped with Pratt & Whitney engines, were grounded after an F-16 based at Luke crashed during a training mission last month. An inspection revealed hairline cracks in some of the engines. This is NPR News. The Federal Aviation Administration says a new $2 billion system for the nation's major airports will be delayed further while it undergoes testing at some smaller airports. The project was already behind schedule. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
The FAA says the equipment known as the Standard Terminal Automation Replacement System, or STARS for short, will first be tested at air traffic control centers in Syracuse, New York, and El Paso, Texas, starting late this year. The system was originally scheduled to enter civilian service at Boston's busy Logan Airport last December. FAA officials say changes in the system design requested by air traffic controllers are the reason for the delay. The system is supposed to provide greater capacity and backup capability in guiding air traffic within 50 miles of airports. In light of the delay in deploying the new equipment, the FAA will install temporary upgraded color controller displays at major airports in New York City, Dallas-Fort Worth, and Washington, D.C. starting next summer. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
A conservative group has been given permission to question former Democratic fundraiser Johnny Chung. A magistrate says Chung can be deposed by Judicial Watch in a lawsuit regarding the alleged sale of Commerce Department trade mission seats in exchange for campaign donations. Chung also has been called to testify on Capitol Hill. Chung could become available for questioning in the lawsuit after investigators from the House Government Reform Committee complete their interviews of him this week in California. Chung was sentenced to 5 years probation after admitting that he made $30,000 in illegal contributions. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, home of the Internet and more than 2,000 IT companies, on the web at fairfaxcountyeda.org.
Support for the exchange comes from our contributing listeners and Laconia Savings Bank offices located in Laconia, Guilford, Moultonboro, now Concord, member FDIC, equal housing lender, Angela's Pasta and Cheese Shop, Manchester, now offering catering at home or office, pickup available, information at 625-9544, and Hunt Community of Nashua, an accredited continuing care retirement community featuring apartments, assisted living, and nursing services, 1-888-258-HUNT or at huntcommunity.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. The next time you turn on a light, eat frozen food, use a computer mouse, a telephone, or a disposable diaper, think for just a moment about the person behind that invention. All of these products were created by individuals, independent or university inventors, not the research staffs of large companies. And many of them traveled a tough road from that first great idea to a successful product. Inventing's backbone is the patent, which is guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. The National Patent Association says by protecting and encouraging inventions, patents are directly tied to America's economic success. But there's concern now among some inventors that patent protections are threatened by some legislation in Congress. And there are fears that America is losing its innovative edge. Almost half of U.S. patents today are issued to people from other countries. Today in The Exchange, inventing. We'll look at the history of American invention, the different types of people who are the inventors, and some concerns about the future. Also, some practical information. If you've got a bright idea, we'll talk about turning it into a usable product. Join us with your phone calls. The Exchange phone numbers are 1-800-892-6477, in Concord 224-8989. With us in the studio is John Rochelow. He's an independent inventor and president of Becca Tools, Inc., a product development company based in Concord. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Also with us, Chris Blank, a professor at Franklin Pierce Law Center, which is known for its patent law program. Chris is also involved in the New Hampshire Inventors Assistance Program and is faculty advisor to the Innovation and Creativity Clinic at Franklin Pierce. And Chris, it's nice to have you. Thanks.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
Joining us in a few moments will be Joanne Hayes Rhine. She's editor of Inventor's Digest, and she's president of the United Inventors Association of the USA. What are some of the great inventions, Chris, that you think have really changed the way people live? Some of the great American inventions.
Well, of course, there's a lot of them. With summer coming up, I always thank whoever invented air conditioning, which actually transformed a lot of American life. It made it possible for us to work 12 months a year. I don't know if that's a blessing, I guess that's how progress works. Sometimes we don't like all of it, but there's lots of them. Numerous ones involving transistors that have led to computers, radio, which, well, we call it an American invention, was made by somebody from a foreign country who came to the United States and perfected it and commercialized it.
Now, there's probably a huge list of inventions that have really changed life, but those are some of the ones that stand out.
Yeah, it's hard to pick them all out. There's now almost 6 million patents in the United States that have been issued since the beginning of the country until the present date. So it's really hard to point them out. They range from high-tech lasers to low-tech things that sometimes are quite important to us, like diapers. For instance, and everything in between. So it's really hard to sort all of those out, I think.
What would you put on the list, John?
Velcro is certainly a very important thing. You see that on a lot of commodity items. It's simple. There are a lot of simple inventions that have become enormously successful. Post-it notes, for instance. There are a lot of things that we use in our everyday life that people take for granted, but really have changed our lifestyles.
Post-it notes are one of my favorites. I'm trying to think what I did before they were invented. What have you invented, John? You brought some things in.
I started out with a myriad of tools to use in my primary business, mechanical contracting, a multifunctional ratchet system to install flanges, which are used for circulating pumps. We went down that long road of tool development for a couple of years to conclude that it wasn't significant enough to create repeat sales. We needed something that was going to sell huge quantities in order to reap benefits of royalties or a reasonable profit margin to, address the going concern. So it developed into a line of flanges, valves, fittings for the mechanical industry.
You brought some of this stuff along. How would these heavy pieces of round metal make my life easier?
Not you per se, but the plumbing heating contractor that would come into your home would use these things and would make his job easier, which could indirectly lessen the load on your pocketbook if he could save time in installing this stuff.
Chris, who are the inventors in America? Are they always sort of engineering-minded people like John?
Not at all. I mean, what we really see is a really broad range of people who are inventors. In the Innovation Clinic at Franklin Pierce Law Center, we see people at the beginning process of the legal process to get patents. And we see everybody from teachers to mechanics to stay-at-home wives to professionals to scientists, engineers. It's really all across the board because inventing is really not necessarily about technology. It's really about solving problems that people encounter. And of course, nobody is absolutely immune from having problems. And it's very human to come up with solutions. And so once you've sort of passed that step, you're in the possible range of getting a patent for an invention that you've made if you've actually solved the problem. So it's really a wide diversity of people, right across the board. So one of the first things you have to get out of your mind, and I tell my students, because I train lots of people who will be patent lawyers, is don't look at somebody's technical background as an indication of whether or not they're inventive. You can get highly technical people who aren't inventive and people who aren't terribly inventive or terribly technically qualified who are very inventive. There was a story about Edison making the light bulb and coming up with a tungsten filament. And he said, well, thank goodness I didn't know it was impossible when I started because I would have given up. But fortunately, because I was stupid, I kept on and tried to do something that everybody who was an expert would say was impossible. And I came up with an improved filament and the kind of filaments that we use in standard light bulbs even to this day, 100 years later. So
if I can chime in on that, to borrow an overused cliche, necessity is the mother of invention. Everyone in everyday life reaches some kind of obstacle where they need to invoke their creative processes to find a solution to that. And Chris is absolutely right. You know, people, I think, place inventors kind of on a plateau and you know, the exalted inventor, which is couldn't be further from the truth. You know, after 3 years of developing the inventions that I've come up with, I've concluded that anything is possible. You have to look at it from a point of view that isn't limiting. We're so used to being creatures of habit of doing the same thing the same way all the time. We have to break away from that. And, you know, sometimes there's a fine line between ridiculousness and creativity. And you just need to kind of hone in on those creative juices that flow in everyone.
So are often inventions an accident?
Post-it notes were, you know, the somewhat sticky, you know, adhesive that they put on those. Sure, that was a byproduct of another invention or avenue they were going down. But certainly, not for me, but...
For you, you sit down and say, what's the problem and how do I go about solving it?
Yeah, I've always deliberate. I've been a troubleshooter, a technician, and that's how I've been able to overcome the obstacles.
That's one of the problems, because the patent system in the United States is a system that creates incentives, not rewards, to make inventions. So it doesn't ensure that, you know, you're going to hit the jackpot. And what it's trying to really do is make people come up with new innovations. And one of the troubling things when we look at this from a scholarly viewpoint are the economics of innovation are troublesome because they're not always rational. Quite often they are, but they aren't always. And one of the examples that I think probably most American school children learn about is the invention of cured rubber that was made by, I can't remember if it's Firestone or Goodyear or somebody of that sort. And the story is that the person was trying to cure natural rubber for years and years and couldn't figure out how to do it, and poured sulfur by accident into a pot of latex that he was cooking in his kitchen, and you know, looked at it, and it cured, and it was solid, and voila, you know, you have this cured rubber. And there's a couple of things you can learn from that. One of them, I think, is that, you know, invention isn't always rational and designed, and the other one is that you probably should never go to dinner with somebody who's working on chemical inventions because they have some odd things in their kitchen. But that's one of the interesting things about this system is when we try to engineer this from a legal perspective, we don't really have set rules of understanding how it works.
And in just a moment, I want to ask both of you about that patent process, Chris. So I'm glad you brought it up. But one more thing about the individual inventor. Do most of them work on their own? Are they those housewives and plumbers that you talked about, Chris? Or are some of them working for major companies that pay them to sit around and invent all day? John?
Of course, I worked on my own until the money ran out, and then my investor came on board. And certainly without her, it wouldn't have ever developed into a product that we were eventually successful in licensing. It would have fallen way short of that. But I think that going through the promotional phase of my business and demonstrating at trade shows, et cetera, I learned that a lot of people have ideas. They just don't know how to go about developing them. And as you said earlier, there are a lot of engineers with big companies that don't have that creative, you know, flow that they're able to easily tap into. So I think it is up to the independent guy to, you know, facilitate cutting-edge technologies and bring it to a higher level, maybe to that manufacturer, which is what I did.
I think in straight percentages, if we looked at the turn of this century, which is almost over, more than two-thirds of the inventions were being made by what we'd call now independent inventors. They weren't assigned. These people weren't working for companies. That ratio has almost flopped. So that about one-third of inventions now are made by independent inventors at the close of this century. It's still significant, though, that that's a very large percentage. If we look at patenting and inventions across and around the world, that's still a significant portion of American invention. And I think that percentage has shifted because people aren't, at the end of the century, as aware of the patenting process as they were at the beginning of the century. If you look at sort of popular literature of the time, you see Steinbeck writing about people who make get patents in the beginning of the century. You don't see that in sort of, you know, common culture, popular culture now. And one of the things that the Innovation Clinic at Franklin Pierce really tried to do is to educate people, citizens of New Hampshire, about the patenting process and the availability to them, and try to make it a little bit more accessible to them.
That's interesting. So at the beginning of the century, your average American was more aware of, tuned into the idea that there's a patent process out there, that you can take advantage of it if you want to invent something, that you can do this.
I think so. I think at the time there was almost this American hero figure of the inventor, of Tesla and Edison, you know, that were in the news regularly, that were public figures, and people could look to them and wonder, you know, why can't I do that? And people would do that on a regular basis. And you see accounts of some engineers and inventors who emigrated to the United States, and they saw this in the press and said, oh, this is the place to go. You know, if you're an inventor, you want to get to the United States. They have a system that will help you become more successful.
What do you think about that shift, John?
Well, you know, I don't know if I would prefer to be back in the beginning times of the patent process or now. I think now there's a lot more technology to behold, to take advantage of, to facilitate that creative process. Although back then, it was a new frontier. And when you break through a frontier, you realize the possibilities. You know, it's a formidable task to go through the patent process. One, it's expensive. Two, it's no guarantee that your product, your invention will be successful. That requires a lot of money. And that requires a lot of staying power and determination. I was particularly driven. I wanted to make this my new livelihood, and drop, you know, leave the old career behind. And I wanted to develop as a person. And I thought that my inventions could help me do that. But, you know, big companies are out there looking to prey on little guys with inventions. And it becomes a learning process. You definitely need to educate yourself on the forces that are out there that act upon that. Whether you have a patent or not, you have to defend that patent. You have to be able to afford to defend the patent.
You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy, and today we're talking about inventing. We're looking at the role inventors have played in our country, also the legal hurdles inventors face, and some practical advice soon on how to turn a bright idea into reality. 1-800-892-6477 is The Exchange 800 number, in Concord 224-8989. Do you have any questions or comments about everyday inventions, such as the telephone or the computer mouse or Velcro? Or have you ever had an idea that you thought would make a good invention? Have you ever dreamed about turning that invention into a product on the market? 1-800-892-6477, in Concord, 224-8989. Protection of inventors is included in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 says authors and inventors will have, for a limited time, exclusive rights to their writings and discoveries. Joining us in the studio, Chris Blank. He's a professor at Franklin Pierce Law Center, which is known for its patent law program. Chris is also involved in the New Hampshire Inventors Assistance Program and is faculty advisor to the Innovation and Creativity Clinic at Franklin Pierce. Joining us also is John Rochelow, an independent inventor. He's president of Becca Tools, Inc., a product development company based in Concord. One more time, the exchange phone numbers, 1-800-892-6477, in Concord, 224-8989. So let's get down to the nitty-gritty. I have a great idea, Chris. What should I do?
Well, a very short answer.
Don't tell anyone.
First, you know, there are some dangers in telling other people. So you want to first sort of keep it to yourself. And if you do tell it to somebody else, make them enter into some form of agreement of confidentiality and try to document that as thoroughly as possible so you can use it. But it is really important that you not share your idea, because when you do that in the United States, and we're different from a lot of countries, other countries, if you do it in other countries, it's over if you haven't had that duty of confidence set up and in place. But you have a one-year period of time after your sort of first public use and disclosure in order to file a patent application. Now, what most inventors do in the United States is they go to the yellow pages and they go and they hire a patent attorney, which is an expensive proposition. There are very few patent attorneys in the country. They do work that's economically viable and very critical, so they're highly paid. But there are things that you can do, and we've tried to, at Franklin Pierce, to teach people what they can do on their own to lower that barrier of entry if they have the time to do that. So we try to get people and to teach them how to write their own patent applications. Not that they'll file what they write, but they'll at least be able to go to an attorney with something that describes their invention already. And fortunately now, with the internet and the information age upon us, there's lots of great resources to find out what other kinds of inventions have been made that are sort of close to yours, so that you can show that your invention's new and define it in such a way so that you're claiming what's new. A couple of these resources that are important to look at our internet sites. So the Patent and Trademark Office has one at uspto.gov, and you can search patents that have issued since 1970 on that. And another one is, I believe, you might have to transpose this, patent-ibm.com. And this is a free database where you can search U.S. patents and European patents that have issued since 1970. For more information, because we try to keep this up as a resource for inventors, you can go to fplc.edu, and we have some other searching engines that you can look at.
FPLC, Franklin Pierce Law Center.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can go to the website rather than visit us because, you know, lots of things are going on there. The website's always up. Another resource is that there's a depository library from the United States Patent Office here in Concord at the State Library, which, because it's a federal collection, anybody can go in and look and search it. And they have microfiche of patents going back any number of years. Another source is the Boston Public Library, which is also probably the best depository library in the country, and they have patents going back as far as they are available. There was an unfortunate fire in 1812 in Washington, and some things burnt down, but they almost have the whole patent collection. So you find out what was back there, and you can define what's new, because the first hurdle is that your invention has to be new. You heard the phrase, you know, you've invented the wheel again or something of that nature. We don't give patents for things that existed already. It's got to be new.
Independent creations, I believe they call those.
Yeah.
Tell us about your journey, John, briefly.
Sure.
How did you go from having an idea to actually having a successful company selling your idea?
I started with a task that required a new tool or a new means of performing the task. And it was with a simple flange. I did create a tool as a prototype, and I brought the prototype directly to a patent attorney. I didn't have the time, I felt, with two businesses to do a lot of the research. And it's almost an art form, searching through the web, through those websites that Chris just mentioned. However, I did go to Boston Public Library and did a lot of research there. But for the most part, my patent lawyers made tens of thousands of dollars on me. I've lost track of the number of applications that we've filed, it's six or seven or eight or somewhere around there. And along the way, I did discover that some of the creations of mine were independent creations as opposed to novel inventions.
And what's the difference?
An invention is something that typically is patentable, where an independent creation is something that someone previously created or patented, and you've just done it again. You've reinvented the wheel, not being aware that the wheel was already out there.
So your patent search revealed that?
None of my patent searches. In fact, there's so much data to search. It's very difficult to channel, you know, directly toward what it is you're looking for. I, for instance, looked up flanges and came up with, you know, just an unwieldy number of different flange applications in medical industry and aerospace, yada, yada, yada. Didn't find anything that looked like my invention. So it's a long, arduous process that if you can do yourself, that's great. You can save a lot of money. And if it's a part-time thing, if you're not as driven as I was to make it your new livelihood.
So once you discover that, yes, indeed, this is new, and yes, indeed, I can get a patent for it, you need to perhaps, Chris, get somebody to help you with the actual marketing and financing and putting this thing together. And that's where some people seem to fall short.
Well, you're going to have to use it in a business. That's absolutely right. You might also and will likely need a patent attorney at that point to go through the process that's called patent prosecution, because we don't have a registration system. We have a system where your patent application, after you write it, has to meet certain legal requirements, goes down to the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and they have a core of examiners. And out of this, they have a system to do this. An examiner will be chosen that has the technical background, and they will examine your patent to see if it's new, and then if it meets the second requirement, whether or not it has an inventive step in it, whether it's unobvious to those skilled in the art in that field. Because we don't give inventions the things that people would make otherwise, you know, just as a natural matter of course. We want a little bit, you know, more creativity than that. It's a very difficult standard. And that's probably where you're going to need a patent attorney at that point to get it through the patent office so that they'll issue it.
Let's take some calls, gentlemen. Again, the exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477 in Concord, 224-8989. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. We're talking about inventing today. Our first call is from Plastow. Todd's in his car. Hi, Todd.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, my question is what is the legal difference between an actual patent versus a patent pending?
You see that all the time on stuff, don't you?
Right.
Pat pending, yeah.
Because it is an examination procedure rather than a registration procedure, while the application is before in the United States Patent and Trademark Office being examined to see if it meets all the requirements, it's pending. Okay, so the patent pending notice is to give people notice that this product or apparatus or whatever it is might be patented and they can't rely on using it freely, because the patent system is a compromise on a real basic, very old human right, which is the right to copy things that aren't protected otherwise. So the patent pending's notice, gee, don't rely on this. You know, you might want to wait and hold up because there might be a patent that comes out and then you're going to be in trouble if you're copying this.
So it's
invention.
A warning.
Yeah.
And the pending stage could go on for years and years, especially if there's litigation. I was issued a patent, and it took about a year and a half. It went through fairly smoothly on a particular device that I created. However, a number of the others remain pending and can be there for a long time.
Good question, Todd. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's go next to Sutton. Ron's on the air. Good morning, Ron.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm an inventor. And I've had some interesting problems and situations with patent attorneys in Washington. Like the individual that's on your program that was saying that he had spent tens of thousands of dollars on attorney fees, so have I. And in one particular case, I was ripped off quite blatantly by an attorney. He reinvented my invention, basically. He was sending me back altered designs of my invention for me to okay them, and I kept sending them back to him saying, this isn't my invention, you totally misrepresented my invention. And at one point he just stopped communicating with me. I had to get another attorney to sue him to get my money back that I paid him initially to get my patent. So there's a lot of convoluted situations where people have to be really, really careful. And there's no guarantees. A lot of these invention companies that you see on TV and you see in magazines, they're ripoffs.
Yeah, actually, Ron, I wanted to pick up on that quickly. I have seen in all the materials on inventing, watch out for these, I don't know what you'd call them, John, invention marketing companies, you know, companies that say, we'll help you make your invention a reality.
Or promotion companies.
Right.
In fact, the United States government is looking into this as an unfair trade practice. So I think it's very important when you choose an attorney in any kind of field is to feel comfortable with them as much as possible. And, you know, I would be concerned about if you don't think you have a good relationship going on with an attorney, do something. For Ron's benefit, there is an Office of Enrollment and Discipline in the USPTO. And if you think this was a serious affair and a serious miscarriage of trust, you should contact them in some regards because there is a disciplinary procedure that's available. We have a hard time because attorneys are important in this process, and if they don't meet all of their duties and obligations, the system doesn't work as well.
So, Ron, how's it going for you now?
I've completely dropped out of the process because of I've lost all my money to it.
Well, one of the things, Ron, is the disciplinary system doesn't cost anything. There's no filing fee. So it might be helpful, and it might not rescue you, but I think it would be important to the overall process to make sure if there's an attorney out there who is breaching some duties and obligations to clients.
I'm not saying they all are. I'm just saying that there are a few bad apples in this. Barrel. The other thing is perhaps we should look at a different type of system instead of such an adversarial system which breeds excessive gains on the attorney sides. I believe where if there were a mechanism set up where enough inventors got together with a few decent attorneys keep the cost down, I think that would be a lot more advantageous because it is. There's too many hurdles. There are just too many things that, with a really good invention, if you go before a board, and I've gone before many boards that have just, this is an idea that's going to go somewhere. If you could just come up with $10,000 to put it through, I'm sure you're going to make some money on it. And these are, honest individuals. Some invention companies are legitimate, and they will advise you as to, go for it or don't go for it. And I've had some, good return on that.
It's hard, Ron. It's definitely a tough road.
It's a real tough road, and I think it should be revamped because I think the attorneys, honestly, are making too much money on this stuff.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Ron. Bye-bye.
Ron, to follow up on that, don't feel atypical. 97% of inventors never become successful in the market with their invention.
97%.
That's a huge failure rate. And it has to do a lot with exactly what Ron's talking about. There are a lot of hurdles, and not only with attorneys. The first attorney I went to, I could see the writing on the wall with. He was going to take advantage of me. It was a job security thing for him. But also, if there are manufacturers, companies out there in the marketplace that stand to benefit greatly by your invention, I think you're more vulnerable there. I've dealt with a lot of companies that were all ears and all eyes when it came to my inventions, but when it came to putting up, a license agreement or something, they couldn't do that.
In a moment, more on independent versus corporate inventors. We'll talk with Joanne Hayes Rhines, editor of Inventor's Digest magazine and president of the United Inventors Association. We'll also take a lot more of your phone calls, so stay with us and stay on the line. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Wednesday on The Exchange, mental health coverage. Join us tomorrow for The Exchange.
Support for The Exchange comes from our contributing listeners and Hunt Community of Nashua, an accredited continuing care retirement community featuring apartments, assisted living, and nursing services. Information 1-888-258-HUNT or at huntcommunity.org. Eastern New England Volvo retailers featuring the brand new 1999 S70 sedan and V70 wagon. The sign and drive program is available now at a local Volvo retailer. And A.G. Edwards & Sons, offices in Claremont, Concord, Hanover, Keene, Nashua, New London, and Portsmouth. Investments since 1887. Members NYSE and SIPC.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy, and our topic today is inventing. We're looking at the role inventors have played in our country, also the legal hurdles inventors face, and some practical advice on turning a bright idea into reality. On Saturday, May 8th, more than 250 New Hampshire students will gather in Penacook for the 13th annual Young Inventors Celebration. It's the culmination of a year-long series of invention-oriented events. The students will be recognized for their inventions. We'd like to hear from you this morning, 1-800-892-6477, in Concord, 224-8989. Our guests are John Rochelow, an independent inventor and president of Becca Tools, Inc., and Chris Blank, a professor at Franklin Pierce Law Center, which is known for its patent law program. They tell us that many common products were created by independent or university inventors, not by people associated with a major company. Some of these products include frozen foods, airbags, disposable diapers, the cotton gin, the telephone, FM radio, and the grocery cart. Joining us now briefly on the phone from Boston is Joanne Hayes-Rhines. She's editor of Inventor's Digest, and she's president of United Inventors Association of the USA. And Joanne, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
You've made a name for yourself, Joanne, as an advocate for independent inventors. Who were some of the great independents in history?
Well, when we talk about independent inventors, I think people usually do think historically as to the Edison and the Wright brothers and Alexander Graham Bell. But the message that the United Inventors Association and Inventors Digest is trying to get out is that there are so many products today created by independent inventors, such as the MRI, the diagnostic tool by Raymond Damadian, the cardiac implantable pacemaker by Dr. Wilson Greatbatch. Two men who created a whole new industry were Roy and Candido Jacuzzi. I think it's kind of obvious what they invented.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, we have a list of about 250 products that people use every day. The ATM, how often do we use that? A guy by the name of Luther Simigian, you know, well-known name, right? But that's the story we're trying to get out, is that if people have an idea for a new product, that they can get it to market. It's not easy, as one of your callers was just talking about, the high cost of patent attorneys and patent fees. Well, that's just the beginning. If they think that a patent attorney costs a lot, they should investigate the costs of having a mold made for a product. That can run into the tens and even hundreds of thousands of dollars. So people need to understand the process of getting a new product to market. And that's what Inventor's Digest talks about, is how can people determine early on, do they have a product that's worth going forward with? And if so, what can they do at a reasonable cost in the beginning? And how can they raise those necessary funds to really get that product to market?
So the high cost of patent attorneys and also figuring out exactly how much it will cost to get a product to market. What else are the particular concerns of independent inventors, Joanne?
Well, one of your other callers hit the nail on the head, too, when he talked about the invention marketing companies. That is a very big problem in this country, because these folks prey on the dreams. And people get an idea, get this neat idea for a new product, and they don't know where to go or who to turn to. Often they're up late at night and they answer one of those 1-800 phone call ads that are on TV or radio. There's a great website. It's www.inventorfraud.com, put up by a patent attorney who right now is in the process of being sued by one of these companies. They ask people for references. It's so easy for, you want to hear the good news about your product idea. You want to hear people tell you you have a beautiful baby, where in reality what you need is for people to tell you maybe this isn't such a beautiful baby. What can you do to improve it? So you need a real critical evaluation early on, and there are several universities and nonprofit organizations who do that.
One last question for you, Joanne. I know you are concerned about two particular bills in Congress in terms of how they affect independent inventors. What would those bills do, and where do they stand right now?
We've been fighting some patent legislation for about 8 years now. Right now, in this current new Congress, there is no legislation that has been introduced, although one is on the drawing boards, Representative Cobble from North Carolina. This legislation has been changed in many ways to adapt to the independent inventor, but there are still two parts of it that we are vehemently opposed to. One is granting prior user rights. We have a system in this country that patents are given to the person who is first to invent. Prior user rights, if this passes, would give rights to trade secret keepers. We don't think that that's what the Constitution had in mind when the Founding Fathers created patent rights. The second is expanded reexamination, which once a patent is issued, this would give people who are contesting the patent expanded rights, would give third parties the right to come in. Again, from the point of the independent inventor, we think this could easily lead to harassment. And I think your inventor talked about the cost of litigation. Patent attorney fees, defending your patent rights is very expensive. And again, the reexamination we think would just be inordinately harmful to the independent inventor.
But as you said, there aren't any bills in Congress of that nature right now.
Not right now. We have on our website, inventorsdigest.com, we can send people an alert about patent legislation, when things are happening, when hearings are held, and that kind of thing. So if anybody wants to sign up for our legislative alert list, they can get that on our website.
Okay, Joanne, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Hey, it's been great. Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Joanne Hayes Rhines, editor of Inventors Digest and president of United Inventors Association of the USA. She's based in Boston. Let's go back to your phone calls. Again, the exchange numbers 1-800-892-6477. The Concord number 224-8989. The next call is from Derry, and it's Barbara. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi there. Good morning. I want to make a particular product and show that there's a market for it and sell the idea to someone else rather than do the long-term production myself. But I'm having a great deal of trouble finding suppliers to provide my components so that I can at least produce this at a reasonable cost as a trial and as a market demonstration. I'm not in manufacturing right now, and I'm not connected. What do I do?
Good question. You can go to a library, your public library, and look in the Thomas Register. That's a listing of manufacturers throughout the country for virtually any product you can imagine, or any anything that's going to go into your product.
The Thomas Register.
Yeah.
And that's a place to get started. Maybe Barbara can write to those people and say, I've got an idea. Could you make me a prototype?
Yeah. She could find out the availability of that the ingredients that she needs.
Chris?
Well, of course, that is a possible thing to do. And, of course, it doesn't really have anything to do with patent law. It really is looking for strategic alliances or partnerships in making a business. One of the things I think that a lot of inventors find out is that to make a business, they have to work with other people. So very often, invention's sort of a solitary act, but commercializing an invention's very much a group activity. And so you have to think about strategies to do that. And there's no perfect way to do it. Remember, most businesses, the percentage of patents that are commercialized is fairly low at 3%. But you have to add in some other statistics. Okay, 4 out of 5 new businesses fail within 3 years. So we're doing that. And then when you start a new business with a new product, that's stacking the cards against you. Really, this whole process of patenting and making new businesses is one that's not high odds. That's why there's a payoff, you know, that you are swimming upstream, and the reward's worth doing if you enjoy, you know, the product or the activity, or you believe in it. It really does require commitment, because inventors and entrepreneurs define themselves by the businesses they undertake.
And Barbara, I can relate to your plight. I ended up licensing 2 products to the market leader that would use this product as an accessory with their mainstay product. Mm-hmm. And it took a long, long time to, it actually took about 7 months to negotiate a license agreement with this company. And in retrospect, I've come to realize that this is probably the only company on the face of the earth that would use my product in the quantity. They'll probably sell 1 million units a year. There's virtually no other company that could benefit as greatly from my product as this company. So I was aware of the company from the beginning, but was reluctant to go to them and say, hey, look at this. Look at my secret.
Now, is that because you didn't want to share it?
I had the fear that I think most inventors share, that I would be ripped off.
Sure.
It didn't turn out that way with that company.
Barbara, I hope that helps.
It does help a lot. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Let's go next to Keene. Hi, Bill. You're next.
Hi. My question, on the first few pages of the magazine Inventor's Digest, there are different ads for patent offices. And what I did is I sent away for the information, and the prices were like $250 for the patent search. And then if they say that your idea is patentable, it was around $1,700. They send you a statement of confidentiality and non-use, and it's signed by the president. And my fear is just getting having my idea stolen. Or my question is, am I pretty safe? The pamphlet they send you is a sketch. They want you to draw out what you've got, briefly describe it, and then there's a signature. So with all that information, and if I make copies, am I pretty safe sending my idea to, you know, a patent office in Maryland, somewhere far away, people that I've never met?
I can understand your concern, Bill.
I think the real question is what kind of services are you going to get for the price that you're going to pay for this? And you have the issue that you don't know these people, where they're at or how they're going to work. I'm willing to bet, Bill, that if you go around and look at patent attorneys in New Hampshire and look at the prices that they'd ask you to pay to get the basic starting protection that would be necessary, that you're going to find out that, in fact, you'll get a better deal by staying and dealing with private attorneys and trying to negotiate fees with them rather than to go to this firm in Maryland. This process, if you're going to be successful, is going to require you to have a good working relationship, I think, eventually with a patent attorney, with an attorney, maybe a business attorney as well. And that's something that you're going to have to learn how to do. And I don't know how you end up learning to trust people that you don't see on these kinds of matters. I mean, I buy stuff over the Internet. But the idea of buying legal services over the Internet or through the mail strikes me as sort of an odd proposition. So I'd really advise you to look at some of the local sources before you commit to doing that. Okay. If you hire an attorney in the state of New Hampshire that does this, or even in Boston, they're going to have obligations as attorneys to maintain confidences, to keep the thing secret, and to act in your best behalf. I can't speak about this firm in Maryland. So.
Right.
I would agree with Chris. You should definitely go through a local attorney. That's why I use Ritchie Law Office in Concord. It's somebody I trusted. They're local. I felt I had some control in the whole process, and I would never go through a company through a magazine or anything like that.
All right, Bill.
All right,
thank you.
Super, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. And our next call is from Dover. Brian, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I'm interested in marketing an invention, or at least I think it's an invention. It's for the Internet, and it's got a fairly novel architecture for switching packets. And I'm not sure that all of it is unique, but as a sum, I feel that it's unique. And how would I go about qualifying something like that?
When you say qualifying, what do you mean, Brian?
Well, I'm trying to find out if the sum of all of the parts of this architecture is unique enough to get a patent.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I'm really doing in my free time, so I don't have a lot of resources, and I certainly couldn't make a prototype.
Get a free consultation from a reputable law firm.
Will they give you a free consultation?
Initially, most of them will.
Chris?
The other thing, Brian, is I'm wondering, I mean, there's lots of information sources on the Internet now, and it sounds like the technology that you're talking about is recent.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you go to any of the free search sites, you can probably make a better idea of what's going on. And if it has something to do with electronic commerce or computers these days, the other things that you can look at, and there's lots of news and information on the Internet about this, are companies who've started up using these information technologies or information technology-based companies. And so there's sort of a path that these people go through. So research is a big key. There's lots of resources there to look at and to help you in your way in making decisions. So it's not necessarily true that you're going to have to make a prototype, but you should educate yourself about your invention as best as possible, because chances are you're going to have to, even when you go to a patent attorney, educate them, because they're not really in the job of making inventions. They're in the job of protecting them.
Now, Chris, you're involved with the New Hampshire Inventors Assistance Program and something called the Innovation and Creativity Clinic at Franklin Pierce. Do either of those help the average person on the street, you know, like Brian?
That was going to be the next thing. If you'd like, you can call the Franklin Pierce Law Center. The phone numbers. Can I give that out?
Sure.
228-1541 and ask for the Innovation Clinic. And we do these kinds of initial consultations and then try to make referrals in certain circumstances where the people really can afford some legal fees. In other cases where they can't, we do the work. The caution is that it's slow because we try to use student labor to get it done, so it's not as fast as going through a law firm, but it's less expensive. And so we try to do a referral service. So we've worked with the local intellectual property bar, negotiating fees with them, trying to get reduced rates in certain circumstances to give inventors more access to the patent system.
Good luck, Brian.
Thanks
for your call. Bye-bye. Let's go next to Barrington. Hi, Paul. You're next. Good morning.
Hi. I'm a postal clerk, and I have a lot of inventors come in with what's called a poor man's patent. And what it is, they send a registered letter to themselves. I just want to know if that's really legal or a good way to do it.
Well, what it is in this case, what you do is you write down what your invention is and you mail it to yourself, certified mail, I believe.
No, it's registered mail.
Registered mail, okay. Then you don't open the envelope.
Right.
And that's proof of when you've made the invention, okay? But it's only proof of when you've made the invention. If you never make an application to the United States Patent and Trademark Office, it really doesn't amount to much. But it can be proof that you had this invention or this idea at a given time and somebody that you thought had undertaken a duty of confidence and you tell the invention or tell them about the invention. If they steal it, this could be proof, you know, that they've actually taken it. So it's good for that purpose. It's good for sort of proving a trade secret in some regards, but it's not really patent protection.
Yeah,
but
it's a good question, Paul. I had read about that, too.
Okay.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we have time for one more. We're going to go to Manchester. Hi, Bob. You're our last caller today.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
My question is it necessary to provide a working model or prototype in order to secure a patent, and must your patent statement, must you swear to it to be true and that it works?
The second one is you have to swear that you made the invention and that you don't have any reason to believe that it doesn't work. But no, you don't actually have to have a working example. In 1946, a patent that most of us didn't get to read about until much later was issued to Enrico Fermi for a nuclear reactor. And there wasn't for generating power. And there wasn't any nuclear reactor for generating electrical power until some years later. And Enrico had never made one.
Well, that would be an easy prototype.
Yeah. And there were some regulatory problems. So no, you don't actually have to have a working example. Of course, if you have one, that's great. But if you know the thing is going to work and you don't have serious doubts that it'll work, you don't actually have to physically embody the invention to file for it in the United States.
You do need to have drawings describing your invention, though.
And drawings showing how it might work.
Sure, and that's part of the patent application.
And you do have to believe that it will work.
Sure, it just can't be pie in the sky. You can't patent something like that.
Is there a regional patent office?
No.
Or do you have to work through Washington?
You have to work through Washington, we have to go down to the United States Patent Office, which oddly enough actually isn't in Washington. It's across the river in Crystal City, but the address is Washington. But it's the federal government, so we get used to these things.
And if your patent turns out not to work, do you have an obligation to inform the Patent Office?
If the invention doesn't work?
Yes. If the patent's been issued and the invention doesn't work, what is your obligation?
Well, actually, your only obligation is while the application is before the office, there is an absolute duty of candor. So if you filed for a patent and you thought that it would work, and then subsequently you did experiments and found out it just didn't operate, it didn't work that way, if your patent application was still in the patent office and hadn't issued as a patent, you'd have a duty to tell them that. But after the patent issues, you don't have a duty to the patent office. But frankly, your patent's probably not valid. So if you tried to enforce it, there would be legal defenses and, you know, all sorts of attorney arguments. And
the patent office is probably looking pretty closely at it, too, to see if it's viable, to see if it's worth issuing a patent for.
They don't presume that the inventions that come into them worth issuing. They have an examination process. They do try to carry their burden to prove that you don't have a right to an invention. And they have trained professionals to do this, you know, who specifically know the law and the technology and are trying to say, you know, here's some evidence, you shouldn't get a patent, and so we're not going to issue one. So this isn't a process where you just write away and get one.
How long does it take, John?
It could vary. As I said, I got a patent in a year and a half, but it could be many, many years, you know, especially if there's litigation. If the patent office rejects your claims or rejects the validity of the invention or whatever, you have to pursue that, and that could be years.
Right now, there's, I think, 600 patents that have been in the office for more than 10 years. So
really?
Applications, yeah,
wow.
So.
Patience.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you
very much.
Chris Blank is a professor at Franklin Pierce Law Center, which is known for its patent law program. John Rochelot is an independent inventor and president of Becca Tools, Inc. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Mary Kruger is the producer, with help from Laura Colbert. Our intern is Judy McGurk. The engineer is Shay Zeller. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
Support for The Exchange comes from our listeners and from Public Service of New Hampshire, proud sponsor of the 1999 Smithsonian.